Chapter 3. The Metabolic Problem Your Doctor Can't See. In this chapter, you will learn, we often say our metabolism slows down with age, but this can't explain childhood obesity. The problem is inflammatory body fat, which slows energy production in our cells. When our cells can't get energy from our body fat, this can make us crave sugar, avoid activity, and gain weight. The name of this metabolic problem is insulin resistance. The World Health Organization describes obesity as the largest health threat facing humanity. In late October 2022, many of the world's greatest medical minds gathered in the gilded rooms of London's Royal Society of Medicine to discuss what might be done to stop its spread. There was just one problem. The presenters had contradictory ideas about what causes it in the first place. Some blamed genetics. Some blamed epigenetics. Some blamed inactivity. Some blamed a lack of shared family dinners due to overburdened parents, chaotic schedules, or so much screen time. Also included in the list of contributing factors were pesticides, herbicides, heavy metals, sugar, corn syrup, and of course, the microbiome. This is by no means a complete list, by the way. At the meeting's closing session, the host expressed his exasperation, saying, "There's no consensus whatsoever about what the cause of it is." In the midst of all this brain power, not one of the speakers invited to share their research at this prestigious event ever mentioned the fact that roughly a third of our calories now come from vegetable oil. Forget for a minute everything you've heard about nutrition. Just consider this one statistic. Industrial vegetable oils now account for up to 80% of the average U.S. person's fat calories and one-third of our total calories. You don't need to be an obesity expert or even a doctor to recognize that anything making up such a large portion of our daily calories certainly warrants mention. You don't need computations to find a striking correlation between vegetable oil intake and obesity, and a striking absence of correlation between obesity and other dietary variables, including, remarkably, calories. Unfortunately, doctors, nutritionists, dietitians, and obesity researchers are completely in the dark about the negative health effects of vegetable oil. I was one of them. In my early years practicing medicine, when my overweight patients told me there must be something wrong with their metabolism, I had doubts. If thyroid and other basic tests came out normal, I'd silently chalk it up to lack of self-control. To all my former patients who came to me for help with losing weight in those early days, I owe you an apology. You were right. You did have a metabolic problem. That problem is insulin resistance. Metabolism is all about energy. Metabolism is about so much more than weight. You've probably noticed that when you wake up full of energy, you feel good, far better than when you don't. This feeling isn't just in your head. It's also in your cells. And this feeling happens more often the healthier your metabolism is and the more efficiently it generates energy. Oxidative stress gets in the way of all that. It prevents you from feeling excited to take on the day. It promotes a metabolic derangement that makes us crave sugary and starchy foods to boost our energy. This metabolic shift toward sugar is called insulin resistance. Insulin resistance is the first step in the development of type 2 diabetes. It is incredibly common, affecting even more of the U.S. population than overweight and obesity. And yet, most people don't even know what it is. In this chapter, we're going to see how vegetable oil gradually disrupts our metabolic health by changing the chemistry of our body fat. As our bodies take steps to deal with that chemical change, we develop insulin resistance. It's a four-step process. 1. Vegetable oil gives us high PUFA body fat with inflammatory properties. 2. When cells try to burn inflammatory body fat, they end up not getting enough energy. 3. To supplement their energy, cells use more of the limited amount of sugar in our bloodstream, causing low blood sugar symptoms. 4. As this continues, the body gradually elevates its blood sugar set point, and in the process becomes insulin resistant. Step 1. Inflammatory body fat. We began to explore this step in Chapter 2 when we looked at two key pieces of research, the Elgin Project and Stéphane Guyonnet's adipose analysis. Both showed that a diet high in vegetable oil builds body fat that is full of oxidation-prone, inflammation-inciting PUFA. Given the evidence suggesting we have too much adipose PUFA today, but that we definitely need some, before we move on, it's important to know how much we need in our diet. For the answer to that, we can turn to Chris Kenobi, MD, an emeritus professor of ophthalmology at the University of Texas, Dallas. He became interested in vegetable oil because it may promote blindness from macular degeneration as a result of the drusen we discussed in Chapter 2. He wanted to know exactly how far out of bounds our current total intake of PUFA is in comparison to the days before vegetable oils. And since our body fat PUFA reflects our dietary PUFA, the answer to that question lies in adipose tissue biopsies. He has spent years unearthing data collected from groups of people living all around the world whose dietary and body tissue fatty acids were analyzed while they were still eating a pre-industrial era diet, free of vegetable oils. This information is also helpful because it tells us what our body fat PUFA concentration should be. The kinds of diets Dr. Kenobi studies are called ancestral diets, meaning they're representative of the kinds of diets people everywhere used to eat. The specific populations he's studied include groups in Japan, Africa, the Maasai, Papua New Guinea, Tukasenta, New Zealand, Tokelau, Sweden in the 1950s, when vegetable oil consumption was still limited, and a few more. You might think these far-flung groups of people would eat radically different diets, and when it comes to specific ingredients, this is correct. However, when it comes to nutrients, all human diets are remarkably similar. Dr. Kenobi's exhaustive research puts the historical PUFA content between 1.5 and 3% of total fatty acids, the rest, 97% or so, being saturated and monounsaturated fatty acids. Very few of these cultures have been properly studied, and it's a small sample size, but the results are consistent and significant. None of these ancestral cultures exhibited body fat PUFA of over 3%. Others have estimated our total PUFA at between 3 and 5%. Even though these experts don't fully agree, it's clear that historical PUFA consumption was significantly lower than it is today. And this has had consequences for our body fat. I think of body fat as a recipe. If the recipe for human body fat calls for up to 5% PUFA, and in 2008 we already had 21.5%, the figure that Dr. Guyonnet found in his research, that's a 400% overage. If you quadruple a main ingredient in any recipe, you're going to change the dish from one thing to another thing entirely. Since that 2008 data is out of step with our current rate of vegetable oil consumption, today, we're likely deviating even further from the human body fat recipe. All this is to say that all of us today are in a completely different metabolic state than people were 30, 50, 80, or 150 years ago, when there was far less PUFA in human body fat. This has important implications for our ability to maintain a healthy weight that we need to understand if we want to understand obesity. When I'm talking about the percentage of PUFA in your body fat, I'm not talking about your body composition. The term body composition typically refers to how much of our body weight is composed of fat on a percentage basis. A healthy body composition for women is between 18 and 24%, and for men, 8 to 25%, although it varies based on age. But this says nothing about how much PUFA we have in that fat. We can have a normal, healthy amount of body fat and still have an abnormally high proportion of PUFA. This was true for participants in the Elgin Project and another, the LAVA study. In other words, whether you're fat or thin, if you've been eating vegetable oil, your body fat is full of PUFA. The recipe overage is the same regardless of a person's weight, and the metabolic consequences of the overage manifest as health problems even among people who are thin. One rather bizarre-sounding consequence of high PUFA body fat relates to its melting point. Just as oil has a lower melting point and is therefore liquid at room temperature when butter stays solid, our high PUFA body fat has a different, flabbier texture than if we followed a low PUFA diet. A giant of modern nutrition science, Dr. John Yudkin, had already noticed this difference back in the 1980s. He wrote, "The fat in a person who habitually takes a high proportion of dietary fat, as vegetable oils, will tend to be rather softer than that of a person whose dietary fat is largely the solid fats of animal origin." I point out this effect of our high PUFA diet to highlight how our new modern diet is doing fundamentally strange things to our bodies. The properties of inflammatory body fat. When scientists look at the fatty acid composition of people with obesity versus without, they often find partly oxidized PUFAs. In particular, they find the precise set of toxic, partly oxidized compounds that Dr. Gerhard Spitteler and others had predicted. These compounds cause oxidative damage that promotes inflammation. Thin people often exhibit these same compounds, although in lower average concentrations. Most scientists don't yet identify inflammatory fat by its partly oxidized PUFA content. They identify it by its biological features, what the cells look like, where the fat tends to build up in our bodies, and what the cells can and can't do compared to normal, healthy adipose cells. Inflammatory fat cells are typically smaller than healthy ones. They often build up in and around our liver, pancreas, and other organs, forming what's called visceral fat. We can't directly see visceral fat without X-rays or other imaging technology, since it's internal, but it makes our bellies bulge. It also accumulates around our heart, where it dramatically increases heart attack risk. Importantly, the problem of inflammatory fat is not just localized to our internal organs. It's everywhere. I'll be calling this problematic fat visceral fat when referring to its location around internal organs, and inflammatory fat when referring to it generally. Pound for pound, inflammatory fat produces fewer satiety signals, such as leptin, and lack of leptin promotes overeating. It also exudes cellular distress chemicals called cytokines. Cytokines normally indicate an infection and thus attract immune system cells called white blood cells. Inflammatory fat is positively crawling with white blood cells, as if it were infected. But in this case, the cytokines are false indicators, which confuses the immune system, contributing to allergies and autoimmune diseases. Importantly, you can be at a normal weight and still have unhealthy amounts of visceral fat. This is very common. Studies have shown that 45% of women and nearly 60% of men who appeared thin on the outside actually had excessive levels of internal adipose tissue, i.e., they were fat inside. This thin outside, fat inside combination is now called TOFI, or simply skinny fat. Testing for inflammatory body fat. There are several ways to find out if you have inflammatory body fat. The most direct test is magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, which shows you exactly where fat builds up inside your body and how much. But this method is expensive, and insurance won't cover it. You can also step on a specialized bioimpedance scale that measures how fast electrical impulses travel through your body. And many gyms and health clubs have these. They're not very accurate, however. The best, simplest test is actually the one that tells you if you are insulin resistant or not. As we'll see when we discuss step 4, insulin resistance is the very earliest sign that high PUFA body fat is disrupting an individual's metabolic health. It may even pick up the problem before you see visceral fat build up. The presence of inflammatory fat is also strongly associated with the absence of normal amounts of muscle. In 2017, human metabolism pioneer Phil Maffetone and his research team proposed their own term to describe this phenomenon of fat replacing normal healthy muscle and other tissues. This new term is overfat. It refers to the presence of excess body fat that can impair health, even for normal weight individuals. Unlike the terms tofi and skinny fat, overfat applies to all people, regardless of their weight. When Dr. Maffetone's team reviewed the global evidence, they discovered overfat at an alarmingly high rate of over 90% in adult males and up to 50% in children. The problem was the worst in the United States. Most investigators have assumed that our desk-bound, sedentary lifestyle is the sole explanation. However, Dr. Maffetone's article specifically counters this notion, remarking that the overfat pandemic has not spared physically active people, including professional athletes in various sports and active U.S. military personnel. The United States may be leading the way in overfat because we led the way in eating soybean oil. Today, every country consumes more of the high PUFA vegetable oils than ever before. It's entirely possible that this decades-long practice of eating foods that build inflammatory body fat has now essentially changed human body composition on a national and, increasingly, global scale. It's affecting young and old, rich and poor. Although the poor are often hit more severely in proportion to their reliance on cheaper foods that are full of vegetable oil. How to de-PUFA body fat. There is no detox formula to clear your body of these toxins, unfortunately. There is just one way to get rid of it. You have to burn it off. Just like you have to burn off any unwanted body fat you may have. I have no doubt that we can get our PUFA levels back down to normal, although it takes a while. One study performed back in 1960 showed that the half-life of PUFA in our body fat ranged between 350 and 750 days, which means it takes that long to clear out just half of it. More recent studies pinpoint a similar figure, 580 days on average. Surprisingly, although the time required doesn't vary much with weight, insulin resistance will extend the time it takes. So, we're looking at 3 or 4 years of avoiding vegetable oils to normalize the amount of PUFAs in our body fat, possibly longer for those who are severely insulin resistant. Fortunately, you will start to feel much better much sooner. Most people notice fewer inflammatory symptoms, such as those we discussed in Chapter 2, almost immediately after stopping vegetable oils. We'll explore how to eat to boost your energy and help your body heal in Part 3. Although we began this chapter by talking about obesity, the problem is not, at the end of the day, a matter of too much body fat. It's a matter of fatty acid chemistry. This is an important distinction, especially with the rise of the healthy at any size movement. When our body fat is full of PUFA, we are, quite tragically, unhealthy at any size. I'm not talking about beauty standards. I'm talking about the ability of human body fat to do its primary job, which is to serve as a source of fuel to our cells. This takes us to step 2 on the path to insulin resistance. Step 2. Inflammatory body fat fails to energize us. We often hear people talking about burning body fat like it's some special state you need to work really hard to achieve. But the truth is, we're all born as fat burners, and we are supposed to easily burn fat between every meal. But when our body fat is inflammatory, it doesn't give our cells the energy they need, and so we can lose this natural ability to easily burn fat. To understand how inflammatory, high PUFA body fat might drain our energy, let's start by discussing where exactly body fat gets burned. Every calorie you've ever burned was incinerated inside one of the tiny chambers in your cells called mitochondria. Every cell contains mitochondria. Some contain thousands. These little chambers are nature's power stations, tirelessly generating energy for your cells, day and night. No matter how much or how little physical work you do, your mitochondria are ready to serve your body's energy needs. Good calories and bad. We've all heard that a calorie is a calorie, as if all calories have equal effects on our weight and metabolism. This is wrong. A calorie is a unit of heat energy, not biological energy. The term tells us how much heat is released when a given food combusts in a device called a bomb calorimeter. An apple releases 100 calories of heat energy, as does a tablespoon of butter. However, some nutrients release heat when burned in a calorimeter, but our mitochondria can't use them for energy, such as cholesterol. Burn a lump of cholesterol and you'll get heat. But if we eat too much cholesterol, our liver eliminates it in the form of bile acids, which wind up in the toilet. So, as you can see, thermal energy and cellular energy are very different. That is the essential flaw in the calories in, calories out model of weight loss. Our cells produce energy in mitochondria, not heaters. So to understand which calories are good and which are bad, we need to understand how our mitochondria metabolize them. Good calories provide mitochondria with clean energy and turn you into a metabolic rock star. Bad calories detonate inside our mitochondria and make us fat and tired. Mitochondria don't melt body fat. They literally burn it, using oxygen, just like a combustion engine. Scientists first glimpsed the inner workings of mitochondria in the 1950s using an electron microscope, which can magnify objects 300,000 times. Light microscopes start getting blurry at a magnification of around 1,200 times. A single mitochondrion is composed of an outer membrane and an inner membrane. The outer membrane is basically a simple envelope enclosing the bean-shaped mitochondrion. The inner membrane is folded into strikingly organized parallel lines that serpentine through the entire structure, making the interior of the mitochondrion look like a miniature marble game. Due to the elegant design of mitochondria, microscopists frequently nominate them as their favorite organelle. Studying the serpentine inner membrane, we find an incredible protein molecule that can only be seen using an even more high-tech tool called X-ray crystallography and computerized visual reconstruction. This protein looks exactly like the world's smallest turbine, complete with the ability to spin. With that tiny spinning turbine, mitochondria generate energy for our cells, a kind of cellular energy called adenosine triphosphate, or ATP. Cells use ATP to power their tiny biological machines, much as people use electricity to power our household appliances. Mitochondria are the whole reason we need to breathe. The oxygen our blood delivers to mitochondria pumps the protons that make those turbines spin. When all is working well, it's an elegant process. The faster those tiny turbines spin, the more ATP your mitochondria make, and the more calories you're burning. Three-dimensional reconstructions of mitochondrial proteins in motion are so awe-inspiring that some see it as evidence of intelligent design. All of this beauty and complexity can be disrupted, however, when we fail to protect our mitochondrial membranes from oxidative stress. The miracle of mitochondria. Paleobiologists who study early life on Earth estimate that evolution took a billion years to create mitochondria. The development began during a period known as the Great Oxygen Crisis, starting about 2 billion years ago. During this time, primitive single-celled plants called cyanobacteria dramatically changed the planet by filling our skies with oxygen they produced as a byproduct of their growth. All that oxygen started killing everything, since cell membranes were not yet prepared to protect themselves from free radicals. This led to the largest mass extinction event our planet has ever faced. The only thing that saved us was the development of antioxidants. That crucial step led to a giant leap forward. With antioxidants protecting their membranes, bacteria could experiment with harnessing oxygen's power to their advantage. The end result of billions of years of such experimentation is our mitochondria, which were originally independently living organisms that got swallowed up by a bigger cell. Mitochondria generated so much energy that life would soon take another major leap forward. Before mitochondria, all life was limited to slow-growing single cells. The ocean was black and the sky grayish-green. After mitochondria, life flourished, the water cleared, the sky turned blue, and the world blossomed into the diversity of plants, animals, and fungi that fills our fossil record with extinct creatures and fills today's landscapes with vivid color. None of us would exist today without mitochondria, and mitochondria wouldn't exist without antioxidants. Because mitochondria contain more oxygen than any other part of our cells, they are more dependent on antioxidants than any other part of our cells. What might antioxidant-depleting, inflammatory body fat do to our marvelous mitochondria when they need to burn it? How PUFAs damage our mitochondria. In 2002, a group of Italian scientists at the Institute for Neurosciences in Padua, Italy, published a study suggesting that forcing mitochondria to burn PUFA might damage the mitochondria and imperil our cells. They tested the effect of various fatty acids on mitochondrial energy output by feeding isolated cells each type of fatty acid and measuring ATP production. The differences were easy to see, and their report included a graph that you can see in the supplementary PDF. It shows that 100% saturated and monounsaturated fats are efficient mitochondrial fuel. 100% PUFA, on the other hand, is not. Within minutes of feeding cells, PUFA's energy production drops. In other words, when mitochondria burn PUFA, their power output goes down. Their experiment suggests that whether it comes in directly from our diet or from our body fat, too much PUFA can do some really, really bad things to both our mitochondria and our cells. Of course, this experiment tested 100% PUFA, and neither foods nor body fat contain 100% PUFA. But the study's findings are nevertheless very important. They show that not all fatty acids are equal in the eyes of our mitochondria. Fatty acids with more double bonds, PUFAs, can stall mitochondrial energy output. Not only that, other experiments performed by the same team showed that when burning PUFA, mitochondria can start spewing free radicals that spark oxidative stress, which can damage everything in the cell, including the mitochondria. This study was not the first to show that PUFA makes a poor fuel for our cells. Scientists were making the same observations as early as 1956. And in 1963, a scientist responsible for our understanding of the mitochondrial turbine, Ephraim Racker, warned about the same effect in an article titled, somewhat provocatively, "Calories Don't Count If You Don't Use Them." Dr. Racker was at the time the chief of the Nutrition and Physiology Department at the Public Health Research Institute of the City of New York. And in 1977, President Jimmy Carter awarded him the National Medal of Science. Dr. Racker was not some armchair nutrition expert seeking attention with a provocative title. He was actually referring to a then popular diet book called, simply, Calories Don't Count. Dr. Racker's article pointed out that the book promoted the increasingly popular polyunsaturated oils used by the processed food industry. And he explained that the book's title was almost accurate because polyunsaturates actually can shut down mitochondrial energy production. So he corrected it to make it more accurate by adding the phrase, if you don't use them. Unfortunately, casual readers may have glanced at the title and thought he was promoting some kind of calorie-free food or fast weight loss scheme and just dismissed it. In reality, he was suggesting that vegetable oils were a very poor cellular fuel and would likely harm our mitochondria with toxic effects. He concluded his article with a solemn warning. More extensive studies on the toxicity of unsaturated fatty acids may be in order before their indiscriminate use in foods or drugs is condoned. It's important to point out that the results of the Italian experiment and Dr. Racker's predictions also jibe with the rules of chemistry we've already learned. Chemistry tells us that uncontrolled oxygen PUFA reactions invariably generate free radicals and oxidative stress. When these reactions occur inside our mitochondria can't produce energy normally and will start leaking free radicals. This process of leaking free radicals consumes antioxidants too, which the body can resupply, but it can take a while. Meanwhile, mitochondrial energy output will not be optimal, and the cell will be exposed to damaging oxidative reactions, toxin formation, and the general mayhem previously discussed. All of this is sometimes called mitochondrial oxidative stress. And mitochondrial oxidative stress is known to promote a variety of diseases for which medical science currently has no effective cures. The cell actually has its own defense against this sort of damage. But activating the defensive mechanism comes at a cost. That defense is to take steps to spend less time burning body fat and spend more time burning sugar. Step 3. Energy-starved cells deplete our blood sugar supply. Medical science is finally beginning to recognize that most people who struggle with their weight are struggling because they're not burning their body fat. In a recent medical conference on obesity in New Zealand, the keynote speaker shocked the audience when he presented metabolic test results showing that some people burn almost no body fat ever. Not at rest, not during an overnight fast, not even with light aerobic exercise, and certainly not with more intense activity, since the harder our muscles are working, the more sugar they use relative to fat. Who are these never fat-burning people? People with ordinary type 2 diabetes, the advanced stage of insulin resistance. These folks are mostly burning sugar instead. Think about the problem of high PUFA body fat from the point of view of a cell. Imagine you were managing a cell and needed to keep operations running. But whenever you brought body fat into the cell to use as fuel, energy disruption slowed things down. You'd want to start looking for an alternative to fueling your mitochondria with fat. Fortunately for you, the bloodstream always contains a small amount of sugar, glucose, which is a much better mitochondrial fuel than PUFA. Unfortunately, our entire bloodstream only contains a teaspoon's worth of glucose. The teaspoon of glucose in the blood cannot provide for the desperate needs of all the sugar-addicted cells in your body, no longer acting as a cooperative community, but thinking only for themselves. Their supply of fuel, normally healthy body fat, has been adulterated by PUFA, causing an increased demand for sugar. The result is hypoglycemia, the medical term for low blood glucose, often referred to as low blood sugar. The healthcare system's callous ignorance of this process is making billions while allowing millions to needlessly suffer and die. Human studies have tested a key element of this idea, the part about PUFA, increasing our body's use of blood glucose between meals. In one study, participants ate either a high or low PUFA diet for a week, and then underwent testing to see how much glucose they were burning after an overnight fast. They found that people getting more PUFA were burning relatively more glucose and relatively less body fat. The fat-burning suppressing and sugar-slurping effects of polyunsaturates have been surprisingly well documented by a variety of other researchers, too. Unfortunately, this effect of PUFA is mistaken for a good thing. Researchers have honed in on the glucose-lowering effect of PUFA, interpreting it as increased insulin sensitivity. Insulin sensitivity is the opposite of insulin resistance, and increasing insulin sensitivity can reverse the condition even in advanced stages of type 2 diabetes. As a result of this backward interpretation, many articles incorrectly suggest that vegetable oils should reverse insulin resistance and diabetes. The incorrect interpretation comes from a myopic viewpoint that focuses only on one cell at a time, failing to consider that using more sugar might negatively affect the body as a whole, particularly between meals when the supply of blood glucose is most limited. We need to burn body fat for energy between meals, while exercising, and during a fast. When body fat can't give our cells energy in these circumstances, we're going to feel hypoglycemic. Hypoglycemia is a condition in which your blood glucose is low, and which will become particularly important in the next chapter. When we're hypoglycemic, we might feel hungry. We might feel tired. Uncomfortable blood sugar lows can sometimes occur a few hours after eating and sometimes wake people up in the middle of the night. This kind of hunger is hard to ignore. When most people get this kind of hunger, they will instinctively eat or drink something to make themselves feel better. To treat the uncomfortable symptoms of hypoglycemia-induced hunger, they may start carrying little snacks to bump up their blood sugar levels to the point where they feel normal again. Some use sugary beverages instead of food. Others use alcohol, which may boost brain energy even faster than sugar. Many people try to prevent their symptoms, taking to eating smaller meals more often. All these habits tend to make people eat just a few more calories than they used to eat, and more than they burn off. Only a minority of people even realize they're eating more than they used to, and even fewer can boost their activity enough to match that extra intake. And so, the vast majority of people caught in this cycle end up gaining weight. It's very important to be able to recognize this kind of hunger in order to learn to prevent it. Not only will recurring bouts of hypoglycemia make most people eat more calories than they can burn, they also force a metabolic shift. You see, the body has its own way of raising blood sugar when it senses there's not enough. This takes us to step 4. Dr. Cate's energy model of insulin resistance. Doctors are taught that insulin resistance begins when cells throughout the body become less able to respond to insulin signal. According to the American Diabetes Association, why this happens is still a mystery. They claim that weight gain and lack of activity are the most important drivers, as if to say we eat too much and we're too lazy. Exactly backward. Insulin resistance develops first, and it makes us gain weight. As far back as 1987, metabolic research showed that body weight is not the driving force. As one study put it, the severity of insulin resistance is independent of the degree of obesity. I've been studying the science for more than 20 years, and the model I've developed takes into account the fact that seed oils promote inflammation and don't support energy formation. This floods our bodies with stress hormones like cortisol and glucagon, making our liver unable to respond to insulin and forcing it to pump out more sugar. Meanwhile, the pancreas keeps producing more and more insulin to try to get the liver to hear the signal. All that makes us eat more and move less. Our malfunctioning metabolism makes us gain weight, not the other way around. Step 4. Fasting blood sugar levels creep upward, and so does fasting insulin. Welcome to insulin resistance. In step 4, the body attempts to adapt to our cells' chronically high demand for sugar by raising our blood glucose levels, keeping them higher than normal between meals and during an overnight fast. This is easily done thanks to our handy, helpful liver. The liver can respond to distress signals from tissues in need of more energy. The liver can, if asked, elevate our blood glucose well above our normal values to meet a temporary need during periods of intense sugar demand, usually due to intense physical activity. When the liver gets these distress signals, it starts releasing more glucose into the bloodstream. Importantly, this is not supposed to be an ongoing thing. But by this point on the road to insulin resistance, the body doesn't get relief from the intense need for sugar. Cells are now releasing distress signals more and more often, and the liver is releasing glucose more and more often, so that our blood glucose levels often exceed normal values. This is very bad. Too much sugar can stick to our cell membranes, joint tissues, and other critical structures, causing widespread damage. To be healthy, our bodies must keep blood glucose tightly controlled in a very narrow range, from about 65 to about 85 milligrams per deciliter, or mg/dl. Normally, blood glucose only goes higher than that shortly after we've eaten. When blood glucose goes much above 85 or so, the pancreas releases the hormone insulin to bring the sugar back down. Insulin lowers blood glucose by telling fat cells to absorb the sugar. After absorbing sugar, the fat cells will convert it into fat so that it can be stored. Insulin also tells the liver to stop raising blood glucose. But here, in step 4, the liver can no longer stop raising glucose just because insulin says so. Here, in step 4, the liver gets contradictory more glucose signals coming in at blood sugar concentrations that would normally be high enough to shut liver glucose production off. Much of the intense demand for sugar here in step 4 is coming from the brain. When other cells use up more glucose than normal, our brain cells often run out of energy, making us feel like our blood glucose is low, even when it's normal. Sometimes we might feel like our blood glucose is too low, even when it's high enough to trip the insulin release switch. And because of that, the liver is often getting instructions to raise the blood glucose level at the same time that it's getting instructions to lower it. Whenever the liver raises glucose, hoping to meet the body's needs, the pancreas releases insulin, hoping to bring the level back down. Inflammatory body fat has pitted our organs against one another, forcing them to engage in an ongoing battle to win control over our blood glucose levels. This causes blood glucose swings from high to low and back again and again. The worse our insulin resistance gets, the higher our blood glucose levels go. At first, the blood sugar levels are only a little high. After a while, blood sugar levels get to the point that our doctors tell us we have prediabetes. As our blood glucose levels climb, the lows don't dip quite so low, but we still feel bad during the dips. Prediabetes or even moderate insulin resistance can make us feel like our blood sugars are low even when they're normal. If insulin resistance remains unchecked, blood glucose numbers get into the range of full-blown type 2 diabetes. Once we've developed diabetes, We often feel like our blood sugars are low unless they are actually high. As diabetes progresses, not only do our peak blood sugars rise higher and higher, so does our baseline blood sugar. People with more severe diabetes have significantly higher baseline levels, meaning their blood sugars may not have been normal in years. Insulin resistance is the body's answer to the energy problem caused by having body fat that is too full of PUFA to give our cells the energy they need. But it's not a good solution. The greater availability of sugar somewhat solves the immediate problems, but not very well. In the long run, insulin resistance completely rearranges our metabolism in ways that ultimately cause a whole new set of problems. Scientists who understand oxidative stress have sorted out exactly how oxidative stress leads to insulin resistance inside a cell. But doctors don't learn about any of that. Instead, doctors learn that insulin resistance is one of those multifactorial diseases caused by abdominal fat, a lack of exercise, too much sugar, stress, old age, inflammation, genetics, and so on. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, it isn't clear exactly what causes insulin resistance, and it won't be until medical science starts paying attention to scientists who study vegetable oil and the mechanisms of its toxicity. Since most people think sugar is the main ingredient causing metabolic illness, I'd like to set the record straight. Sugar builds normal body fat. Vegetable oil builds inflammatory body fat. It's a common perception that sugar causes obesity and drives diabetes. Sugar is addictive, so we seek it out, even when we're not hungry. And it's fattening, since it's empty calories. Eating sugar spikes blood glucose well above the normal range, even when we don't have diabetes. And blood glucose spikes can also promote oxidative stress. To avoid sugar-induced oxidative stress, we should only consume a tiny bit at a time, or just avoid it. All that said, there is reason to be skeptical that sugar is as bad as some people say. Francis Sladek, a professor of cell biology and toxicology at the University of California at Riverside, has been studying soy oil in our food supply for many years. She knew that our intake of soy oil had increased 1,000-fold over the course of the 20th century. She also knew, as many of us do, that our intake of added sugars had increased. And along the way, there has been a parallel rise in obesity and type 2 diabetes. Fructose sugar has been considered particularly unhealthy, fattening, and capable of promoting diabetes, based on the parallel rise in high fructose corn syrup and obesity between 1980 and 2000. But these are just correlations, which can't prove causation. To test causation, she designed an animal experiment. The experiment had two arms, one to study PUFA versus saturated fat, and the other to study the effect of adding fructose to each of those fatty acids. Mice were given a diet based on either coconut oil or soybean oil. The coconut oil diet matched the amount of PUFA we were historically eating back in 1900, before there was much in the food supply. And the soy oil-based diet matched the amount of PUFA we were eating in the year 2000. The results of her study aligned with everything we've discussed in this chapter. The mice eating soy oil built inflammatory fat just as we do. The inflammatory body fat ended up in places body fat normally doesn't go, just as ours does. Fat was everywhere when we opened them up, Dr. Sladek said during an interview. The animals' inflammatory fat was similarly crawling with white blood cells and exuding the same kinds of cytokines found in people. The animals' inflammatory fat-filled organs also showed signs of dysfunction, particularly their livers, which were filled with huge fatty droplets that caused ballooning of the liver cells, the hallmark of fatty liver. When she looked at the animal's mitochondria, she found dysfunction and signs of oxidative stress. Dr. Sladek's study also linked inflammatory fat to diabetes. Even though the coconut oil-fed mice got fat, it wasn't inflammatory fat. They developed only mild insulin resistance, and their blood glucose stayed normal. Only the high PUFA mice developed the extreme insulin resistance and high blood sugars diagnostic of type 2 diabetes. Adding fructose to coconut oil made the mice slightly fatter than the coconut oil alone did, and it caused slightly more insulin resistance. Even still, their blood sugars were completely normal, and all the mice remained diabetes-free. In a surprise twist, adding fructose to the soybean oil actually seemed to protect against the development of inflammatory fat. The soy oil plus fructose mice developed less visceral fat, less liver disease, less insulin resistance, and less diabetes than the mice that got soy oil without fructose. This was rather surprising, given the considerable attention given to high fructose corn syrup in the diet, she said. Fructose is the most fattening, oxidative stress-inducing sugar in our diets, and it failed to promote insulin resistance as efficiently as vegetable oil. So this study suggested that in the which's worst contest between sugar and vegetable oil, it's not even a fair fight. Vegetable oil wins, hands down. By solidifying our understanding of the dietary villain hierarchy, we can concentrate our efforts in the right place. Americans' sugar consumption has actually dropped during the past few decades as our rates of obesity have doubled. Between 1999 and 2016, the average American cut down on total added sugars by roughly 20%. If sugar were the primary driver of obesity, we should be getting thinner, not fatter. Cutting out sweet-tasting sugar is immensely more difficult than cutting out flavorless oils. If there's an easier first step to take that's actually more important, I think people deserve to know. A metabolically different generation. So, just how common is insulin resistance? Incredibly common. In 2019, researchers analyzed data from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey 2009 to 2016, or NHANES, a program of the National Center for Health Statistics, and produced a kind of metabolic report card. Judging by respondents' waist circumference, blood glucose levels, blood pressure, triglyceride and cholesterol numbers, and whether they were taking any related medications, the authors concluded that the prevalence of metabolic health in American adults is alarmingly low. This cluster of symptoms is all part of what is sometimes referred to as the metabolic syndrome, and it is an indirect measure of insulin resistance. More than 200 million Americans were surveyed, and only a little more than 12% of the respondents were considered metabolically healthy. We do have a better, more direct test for insulin resistance available to us that's not done often enough. This value would give us more accurate insights into our population's health. It's called the Homeostatic Model Assessment of Insulin Resistance, or HOMA-IR. The test tells you exactly how much insulin your body uses to control your blood sugar. The more insulin it uses, the more insulin resistant you are, and the more likely you are to already have or to later develop type 2 diabetes and all of its complications. The less insulin it uses, the better your insulin sensitivity and the healthier your metabolism. Getting your HOMA-IR score is relatively easy. You need a fasting morning blood test for blood glucose and a simultaneous insulin level. Plugging those two values into a simple calculator tool, available free online, gives you the final HOMA-IR score. What's not so easy is finding out what number constitutes a normal value. Some experts use a cutoff as low as 1.0, others as high as 3.8. The disagreement comes in part from the fact that these numbers are based on population averages for glucose and insulin, which have been creeping upward over the decades. The experts citing 1.0 are basing their figure on older data than the folks who use 3.8. The 1.0 figure comes from 1985, and 3.8 comes from 2013. In the intervening 28 years, our metabolic health deteriorated. Given this, I think it's wise to use the older value of 1.0 as the cutoff for normal insulin sensitivity. According to data taken from the 2015 to 2018 NHANES, almost nobody in the United States has a HOMA-IR score below 1.3. This data set included 6,247 adults aged 18 to 44. Unfortunately, they used a cutoff of 2.5 or less for normal. So, finding the proportion of people with a score of 1.0 or lower required digging into the supplementary data tables, and even there, I didn't find a precise answer. All I can gather is that the number of people with values of 1.0 or better was so low that it didn't reach the threshold of even reporting how many people fell into this category. Certainly, it would be less than 1%. In other words, nearly all Americans over the age of 18, more than 99%, have insulin resistance. This is a shocking figure. It's gotten less attention than it deserves because the authors used the wrong cutoff for their normal HOMA-IR value. Using a higher cutoff, 2.5 instead of 1.0, puts the prevalence of insulin resistance at just 40%, which is what got reported. Why would they use the wrong value? As our metabolic health has deteriorated, our average HOMA-IR has increased. The authors of the NHANES paper chose 2.5 as the cutoff, rather than using the previously determined 1.0 value that indicates metabolic health. In effect, they graded us on a curve, drastically underestimating the real prevalence of insulin resistance among American adults. Insulin resistance is increasingly common in children as well. In 2009, Melinda Southern, PhD, a public health expert with hundreds of publications and dozens of Distinguished Scientist Awards, presented the keynote lecture at the annual American Diabetes Association meeting. She opened with a warning. We have a new generation of children who are metabolically different. Her team of investigators had been studying childhood obesity, and they had recently discovered that the new generation, born between 1990 and 2001, was developing insulin resistance at higher rates than all previous generations. Those with more severe insulin resistance also had high levels of inflammatory fat in and around their internal organs, and their muscles were marbled with fat. Seemingly unaware of the increased consumption of vegetable oils and their ability to cause insulin resistance, she and her team had not explored the connection and could not explain why any of this was happening. She also warned that the younger generation's issues extended beyond obesity and diabetes. Insulin resistance also made children less likely to grow normal amounts of muscle or to reach average height. Others have shown that obese children with insulin resistance are very likely to suffer from sleep-disordered breathing. Sleep-disordered breathing, also called sleep apnea, prevents oxygen from getting to our brains. Children with the condition have been shown to experience a variety of learning and intellectual problems that might haunt them for the rest of their lives. Health problems may be appearing in our younger generations well before insulin resistance develops, although it's hard to say because the HOMA-IR test is so rarely done. We do know that sleep-disordered breathing is becoming increasingly common even in children of normal weight, putting them at risk for the same intellectual complications of inadequate brain oxygen. The newer generations also suffer from a variety of non-obesity-related problems. Every parent knows that rates of life-threatening peanut allergies are up. Autism and learning disorders are increasing. Childhood cancer, while thankfully still rare, has been trending upward since the CDC started tracking it in 1975. Career-ending elbow injuries in children pitching in softball and baseball are also on the rise, as are ligament tears in kids playing soccer. These statistics are just the tip of the iceberg. According to a Blue Cross Blue Shield report published in 2019, millennials are seeing their health decline faster than the previous generation as they age, starting around age 35. Intergenerational sperm counts are plummeting too, having dropped 62.3% since 1973. All of this suggests that children born into a vegetable oil-laden world don't get a fair shot at good health. A grave new world. We are living in a strange time, when our much-celebrated modern high-tech medicine can't explain what causes insulin resistance, a metabolic abnormality that almost everyone has, and that causes untold amounts of suffering. Just as the modern diet is profoundly unhealthy compared to the kind of diet humans historically ate, the modern metabolism is profoundly unhealthy too. The modern diet is nutrient poor and toxin rich. Therefore, the modern metabolism is constantly forced to generate oxidative stress and then adapt to it. The modern metabolism must navigate a delicate balance multiple times a day. It must burn enough body fat to produce energy, but not so much that the oxidative stress starts to damage mitochondria and cells. The adaptation our metabolism most often settles into is to burn less body fat and more sugar between meals. The modern insulin-resistant metabolism is simply not capable of generating energy as nature intended. It's best defined as an inefficient metabolism. It's so inefficient that our daily lives are full of energy disruptions. Generating energy is not supposed to be this much of a challenge. Life is all about adaptation. Over the course of our own long evolutionary journey, our metabolism and our DNA have adapted to myriad swings in atmospheric sulfur, methane, and oxygen, and to 100-degree changes in average global temperatures, years without sunlight, and more. We've just seen that our metabolism is now adapting to this bizarre new source of energy we've forced upon it by ratcheting our blood sugar levels up higher and higher. As our organs fight over how much sugar should be in our bloodstream, we are subjected to blood sugar swings. Most of us now need higher than normal blood sugar levels just to feel okay. And many also now have blood sugar levels so high that we are considered diabetic. What sort of effect might this barrage of altered metabolic states have on our behavior? In the next chapter, I'm going to show you some of the research in this field that suggests filling our body fat with vegetable oil is changing our relationship with food and with one another. I'll show you how our modern metabolism subjects our brains to energy shortages that are altering our eating habits, killing our desire for activity, sabotaging our self-control, blunting our ability to plan and to relate to friends and family, and even hijacking our sense of well-being and self-worth.